Chapter 142, which contains births, marriages, and deaths. Whatever Becky's private plan might be by which Dobbin's true love was to be crowned with success, the little woman thought that the secret might keep, and indeed, being by no means so much interested about anybody's welfare as about her own, she had a great number of things pertaining to herself to consider, and which concerned her a great deal more than Major Dobbin's happiness in this life. She found herself suddenly and unexpectedly in snug, comfortable quarters, surrounded by friends, kindness, and good-natured simple people such as she had not met with for many a long day, and, wanderer as she was by force and inclination, there were moments when rest was pleasant to her. As the most ardent Arab that ever careered across the desert over the hump of a dromedary likes to repose sometimes under the date trees by the water, or to come into the cities, walk into the bazaars, refresh himself in the baths, and say his prayers in the mosques, before he goes out again marauding, so Joe's tents and pillow were pleasant to this little Ishmaelite. She picketed her steed, hung up her weapons, and warmed herself comfortably by his fire. The halt in that roving, restless life was inexpressibly soothing and pleasant to her. So, pleased herself, she tried with all her might to please everybody, and we know that she was eminent and successful as a practitioner in the art of giving pleasure. As for Joe's, even in that little interview in the garret at the Elephant Inn, he had found means to win back a great deal of his goodwill. In the course of a week, the civilian was her sworn slave and frantic admirer. He didn't go to sleep after dinner, as his custom was in the much less lively society of Amelia. He drove out with Becky in his open carriage. He asked little parties and invented festivities to do her honor. Tapeworm, the charge d'affaires, who had abused her so cruelly, came to dine with Joe's, and then came every day to pay his respects to Becky. Poor Emmy, who was never very talkative, and more glum and silent than ever after Dobbin's departure, was quite forgotten when this superior genius made her appearance. The French minister was as much charmed with her as his English rival. The German ladies, never particularly squeamish as regards morals, especially in English people, were delighted with the cleverness and wit of Mrs. Osborne's charming friend, and though she did not ask to go to court, yet the most august and transparent personages there heard of her fascinations, and were quite curious to know her. When it became known that she was noble, of an ancient English family, that her husband, and was a colonel of the guard, excellence, and governor of an island, only separated from his lady by one of those trifling differences which are of little account in a country where Werther is still read, and the Wolverine Shafton of Guy is considered an edifying moral book, nobody thought of refusing to receive her in the very highest society of the little duchy. And the ladies were even more ready to call her due, and to swear eternal friendship for her than they had been to bestow the same inestimable benefits upon Amelia. Love and liberty are interpreted by those simple Germans in a way which honest folks in Yorkshire and Somersetshire little understand, and a lady might, in some philosophic and civilized towns, be divorced ever so many times from her respective husbands and keep her character in society. Joe's house never was so pleasant, since he had a house of his own as Rebecca caused it to be. She sang, she played, she laughed, she talked in two or three languages, she brought everybody to the house, and she made Joe's believe that it was his own great social talents and wit which gathered the society of the place round about him. As for Emmy, who found herself not in the least mistress of her own house, except when the bills were to be paid, Becky soon discovered the way to soothe and please her. She talked to her perpetually about Major Dobbin's and about his business, and made no scruple of declaring her admiration for that excellent, high-minded gentleman, and of telling Emmy that he had behaved most cruelly regarding him. Emmy defended her conduct and showed that it was dictated only by the purest religious principles. molested a woman once, and C, and to such an angel as him whom S he had the good fortune to marry, was married forever, but S he had no objection to hear the major praised as much as ever Becky chose to praise him, and indeed, brought the conversation round to the Dobbin subject a score of times every day. Means were easily found to win the favor of Georgie and the servants. Amelia's maid, it has been said, was heart and soul in favor of the generous major. Having at first disliked Becky for being the means of dismissing him from the presence of her mistress, she was reconciled to Mrs. Crawley subsequently, because the latter became William's most ardent admirer and champion. And in those nightly conclaves in which the two ladies indulged after their parties, and while Miss Payne was brushing their hairs, as she called the yellow locks of the one, and the soft brown tresses of the other, this girl always put in her word for that dear good gentleman Major Dobbin. Her advocacy did not make Amelia angry any more than Rebecca's admiration of him. She made George write to him constantly, and persisted in sending Mama's kind love in a postscript. And as she looked at her husband's portrait of nights, it no longer reproached her, perhaps she reproached it. Now William was gone. Emmy was not very happy after her heroic sacrifice. She was very distraught, nervous, silent, and ill to please. The family had never known her so peevish. She grew pale and ill. She used to try to sing certain songs in some Binnich. Nick Allen was one of them, that tender love song of Weber's which in old-fashioned days, young ladies, and when you were scarcely born, showed that those who lived before you knew too how to love, and to sing, certain songs, I say, to which the major was partial, and as she warbled them in the twilight in the drawing room, she would break off in the midst of the song, and walk into her neighboring apartment, and there, no doubt, take refuge in the miniature of her husband. Some books still subsisted, after Dobbin's departure, with his name written in them. A German dictionary, for instance, with William Dobbin, T.H. Reg. In the fly leaf, a guidebook with his initials, and one or two other volumes which belonged to the major. Emmy cleared these away, and put them on the drawers, where she placed her workbox, her desk, her Bible, and prayer book, under the pictures of the two Georges. And the major, on going away, having left his gloves behind him, it is a fact that Georgie, rummaging his mother's desk some time afterwards, found the gloves neatly folded up and put away in what they call the secret drawers of the desk. Not caring for society, and moping there a great deal, Emmy's chief pleasure in the summer evenings was to take long walks with Georgie, during which Rebecca was left to the society of Mr. Joseph, and then the mother and son used to talk about the major in a way which even made the boy smile. She told him that she thought Major William was the best man in all the world, the gentlest and the kindest, the bravest and the humblest. Over and over again she told him how they owed everything which they possessed in the world to that kind friend's benevolent care of them, how he had befriended them all through their poverty and misfortunes, watched over them when nobody cared for them, how all his comrades admired him, though he never spoke of his own gallant actions, how Georgie's father trusted him beyond all other men, and had been constantly befriended by the good William. "Hi, when your papa was a little boy," she said, "he often told me that it was William who defended him against a tyrant at the school where they were, and their friendship never ceased from that day until the last, when your dear father fell." "Did Dobbin kill the man who killed papa?" Georgie said. "I'm sure he did, or he would, if he could have caught him, wouldn't he, mother? When I'm in the army, won't I hate the French? That's all." In such colloquies the mother and the child passed a great deal of their time together. The artless woman had made a confidant of the boy. He was as much William's friend as everybody else who knew him well. By the way, Mrs. Becky, not to be behindhand in sentiment, had got a miniature too hanging up in her room, to the surprise and amusement of most people, and the delight of the original, who was no other than our friend Joe's. On her first coming, to favor the Sedleys with a visit. The little woman, who had arrived with a remarkably small shabby kit, was perhaps ashamed of the meanness of her trunks and bandboxes, and often spoke with great respect about her baggage left behind at Leipzig, which she must have from that city. When a traveler talks to you perpetually about the splendor of his luggage, which he does not happen to have with him, my son, beware of that traveler. He is, 10-1, an impostor. Neither Joes nor Emmy knew this important maxim. It seemed to them of no consequence whether Becky had a quantity of very fine clothes in invisible trunks. But as her present supply was exceedingly shabby, Emmy supplied her out of her own stores, or took her to the best milliner in the town and there fitted her out. It was no more torn collars now, I promise you, and faded silks trailing off at the shoulder. Becky changed her habits with her situation in life. The rouge pot was suspended. Another excitement to which she had accustomed herself was also put aside, or at least only indulged in privacy, as when she was prevailed on by Joes of a summer evening, Emmy and the boy being absent on their walks, to take a little spirit and water. But if she did not indulge, the courier did. That rascal Kirsch could not be kept from the bottle, nor could he tell how much he took when he applied to it. He was sometimes surprised himself at the way in which Mr. Sedley's cognac diminished. Well, this is a painful subject. Becky did not very likely indulge, so much as she used, before she entered a decorous family. At last the much bragged about boxes arrived from Leipzig, three of them not by any means large or splendid. Nor did Becky appear to take out any sort of dresses or ornaments from the boxes when they did arrive. But out of one, which contained a mass of her papers, it was that very box which Rawdon Crawley had ransacked in his furious hunt for Becky's concealed money. She took a picture with great glee, which she pinned up in her room, and to which she introduced Joes. It was the portrait of a gentleman in pencil, his face having the advantage of being painted up in pink. He was riding on an elephant away from some cocoa nut trees and a pagoda. It was an Eastern scene. God bless my soul, it is my portrait, Joes cried out. It was he indeed, blooming in youth and beauty, in a nankeen jacket of the cut of 1804. It was the old picture that used to hang up in Russell Square. I bought it, said Becky in a voice trembling with emotion. I went to see if I could be of any use to my kind friends. I have never parted with that picture, I never will. Won't you? Joes cried with a look of unutterable rapture and satisfaction. Did you really now value it for my sake? You know I did, well enough, said Becky. But why speak, why think, why look back? It is too late now. That evening's conversation was delicious for Joes. Emmy only came in to go to bed very tired and unwell. Joes and his fair guest had a charming tete-a-tete, and his sister could hear, as she lay awake in her adjoining chamber, Rebecca singing over to Joes the old songs of 1815. He did not sleep, for a wonder, that night, any more than Amelia. It was June, and, by consequence, high season in London. Joes, who read the incomparable Galignani, the exile's best friend, through every day, used to favor the ladies with extracts from his paper during their breakfast. Every week in this paper there is a full account of military movements, in which Joes, as a man who had seen service, was especially interested. On one occasion he read out arrival of the TH Regiment. Gravesend, June 20. The Ramchander, East Indiaman, came into the river this morning, having on board 14 officers, and 132 rank and file of this gallant corps. They have been absent from England 14 years, having been embarked the year after Waterloo, in which glorious conflict they took an active part, and having subsequently distinguished themselves in the Burmese War. The veteran colonel, Sir Michael O'Dowd, KCB, with his lady and sister, landed here yesterday, with Captains Posky, Stubble, McGraw, Maloney, Lieutenants Smith, Jones, Thompson, F. Thompson, Ensigns Hicks and Grady. The band on the pier playing the national anthem, and the crowd loudly cheering the gallant veterans as they went into Waits Hotel, where a sumptuous banquet was provided for the defenders of Old England. During the repast, which we need not say, was served up in Waits' best style, the cheering continued so enthusiastically that Lady O'Dowd and the colonel came forward to the balcony and drank the healths of their fellow countrymen in a bumper of Waits' best claret. On a second occasion, Joe's read a brief announcement. Major Dobbin had joined the TH Regiment at Chatham, and subsequently he promulgated accounts of the presentations at the drawing room of Colonel Sir Michael O'Dowd, K.C.C. B. Lady O'Dowd
by Mrs. Malloy Maloney of Ballymaloney,
and Miss Glorvina O'Dowd
by Lady O'Dowd.
Dot almost directly after this, Dobbin's name appeared among the lieutenant colonels. For old Marshal Tipton had died during the passage of the TH from Madras, and the sovereign was pleased to advance Colonel Sir Michael O'Dowd to the rank of Major General on his return to England, with an intimation that he should be Colonel of the distinguished regiment which he had so long commanded. Amelia had been made aware of some of these movements. The correspondence between George and his guardian had not ceased by any means. William had even written once or twice to her since his departure, but in a manner so unconstrainedly cold, that the poor woman felt now in her turn that as he had lost her power over him and that, as he had said, he was free. He had left her, and she was wretched. The memory of his almost countless services, and lofty and affectionate regard, now presented itself to her, and rebuked her day and night. She brooded over those recollections according to her wont, saw the purity and beauty of the affection with which she had trifled, and reproached herself for having flung away such a treasure. It was gone indeed. William had spent it all out. He loved her no more, he thought, as he had loved her. He never could again. That sort of regard, which he had proffered to her for so many faithful years, can't be flung down and shattered and mended so as to show no scars. The little heedless tyrant had so destroyed it. No, William thought again and again, it was myself I deluded and persisted in cajoling. Had she been worthy of the love I gave her, she would have returned it long ago. It was a fond mistake. Isn't the whole course of life made up of such? And suppose I had won her, should I not have been disenchanted the day after my victory? Why pine, or be ashamed of my defeat? The more he thought of this long passage of his life, the more clearly he saw his deception. "I'll go into harness again," he said, "and do my duty in that state of life in which it has pleased heaven to place me. I will see that the buttons of the recruits are properly bright, and that the sergeants make no mistakes in their accounts. I will dine at mess and listen to the Scotch surgeon telling his stories. When I am old and broken, I will go on half pay, and my old sisters shall scold me. I have Gilead and Gelibet, as the girl in Wallenstein says. I am done. Pay the bills, and get me a cigar. Find out what there is at the play tonight, Francis. Tomorrow we cross by the Badavere." He made the above speech, whereof Francis only heard the last two lines, pacing up and down the boomches at Rotterdam. The Badavere was lying in the basin. He could see the place on the quarter deck, where he and Emmy had sat on the happy voyage out. What had that little Mrs. Crawley to say to him? "Saw. Tomorrow we will put to sea, and return to England, home, and duty." After June all the little court society of Pumpernickel used to separate, according to the German plan, and make for 100 watering places, where they drank at the wells, rode upon donkeys, gambled at the redoubts, if they had money and a mind, rushed with hundreds of their kind, to gormandize at the tables d'hote, and idled away the summer. The English diplomatists went off to Teplitz and Kissingen, their French rivals shut up their chancellery, and whisked away to their darling Boulevard de Gand. The transparent reigning family took to the waters, or retired to their hunting lodges. Everybody went away having any pretensions to politeness, and of course, with them,
Dr. von Glauber, the court doctor, and his baroness. The seasons for the bats were the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.